Hello, everybody. This is Shukri, a.k.a. Shu. I just wanted to holler at y'all at the top of the episode here before we actually jump into the official episode and let you know that my partner, who doesn't want to promote himself too much, but I'm telling you, Sherman Payne, he has a movie coming out that he wrote, Charm City Kings, on HBO Max, October 8th, streaming everywhere worldwide. It's a great movie. At least all the reviews say so. I need to check it out too. Check that shit out. That's basically it. Okay, on to the show. What up, Sherm?
Yo.
Today on the podcast, we have the first in, I'm going to call it a series of rising black stars in film and television screenwriting.
Love it.
Kayo Yagan, my former co-workers here today. Can't wait to get into it. Should we start?
Yes, sir. Start the music. Yo, welcome to the Diversity Hires, where Sherman Shu shoot the shit about screenwriting.
We are two working screenwriters living and working in Los Angeles, and we come here every week to this podcast to give you the lowdown on the business, the culture, the craft of writing for film and television with a distinctly black point of view. I'm Shukri Tillman.
And I'm Sherman Payne, a.k.a. the greatest screenwriter of all time, the G-Swope. How are you doing, Shu?
I'm doing okay. It is late September. Fall is upon us. It's the season of sort of, you know, spring is a season of renewal, but I really like fall. I like autumn. I like when leaves change, even though they don't really do that in Los Angeles.
Not at all.
I like, I'm from the East Coast, so I still hold on to that. I like when the weather gets a little bit colder. Going back to school, even though that's not happening for most people across the country, it still gives me a feeling of like a new beginning.
I love how you're naming all of the archetypal changes from summer to fall, most of which don't occur in LA geographically. And then the other things aren't happening because we're in a global pandemic.
But you know what?
You still have that spirit.
Exactly. That's where my spirit is, though. That's where it is. I'm keeping my spirit where it is, where it's supposed to be, and I'm focused on renewal and heading into this fall.
And Shu, you got your pumpkin spice latte. You got your UGG boots.
First of all,
a nice comfy sweater.
Yo, I got my chimney cleaned out. I got logs ready for the fire. I got a stiff drink for nighttime.
It's 80 degrees. What fire? It's 80 degrees.
I got a smoky jacket. Oh, I got a pipe.
This is amazing.
You know what I'm saying? I got one of those hats, you know, like a Scrooge hat at night with the ball on the end.
Okay, we are totally off the rails. Let me bring it back to the subject at hand. Let's talk about something screenwriting related. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay, so something called, according to USA Today, something called the Representation Matters Report has come out. A lot of interesting statistics in this report. They talk about that 2 out of 3 Black Americans say they don't see themselves or their culture represented in movies and television. They said 3 in 4 people surveyed believe the way Black Americans are portrayed in the media influences perceptions of them in the real world. Tons of interesting stuff. I think that y'all should go check out this article. I found it in USA Today. But there is one thing that I would like to focus on. And I think that this is perhaps the most interesting statistic for the sake of our discussion. It says 4 in 5 Black Americans said it's obvious when characters of color and their stories aren't written by people of color. And I want to pose that question to you, Shukri. And I actually like to bring in our guest, even though we haven't formally introduced her yet. I would love to get her opinion as well. Shukri and Kay, do you think that is a true statement?
I will go first and say, at least in television, no. And here's why. Because, look, do I think that there are some instances in which characters are written in such a way that poorly in such a way that you could be like, oh, this just does not feel authentic. Yeah, of course. That happens occasionally, I'm sure. But I think the overwhelming amount of things, it would be impossible to tell because there's just too many cooks in a television kitchen and too many pieces of input that go into a scene, that go into what a character is going to say. The showrunner is going to take a pass on this. And, you know, some pieces of dialogue were written by, like, maybe the black writer who's writing something particular, and another piece of dialogue is written by somebody. It's fucking impossible. I don't think it would be impossible. That's not to say, by the way, I look at a show like The Wire, which is, there's a lot of white writers on it. I'm not suggesting that, you know, only black people can write black voices and only women can write female voices, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that really good writers can write a diverse array of characters. If they can't, they're shitty writers to begin with. And maybe run into shitty writing, of course. Mm. But I don't think my guess is there, if you really surveyed those people, what they thought was authentic and what they thought wasn't, who they thought was behind the pen, they would be wrong quite a bit of time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with everything Shu just said, because it's just sort of like good. I think anyone that is saying that they can tell a person potentially, this is, I don't want to use a generalization, but it's like a lot of times what you're locking in on is someone who wrote something that's stereotypical. Yes. And so if that's the case, and then you're feeling like, oh, there's a distancing between you and that character, so you feel like a different race of person wrote it, there's just a world where, you know, more nuance is needed for the writing of that story, honestly, and just sort of, you know, better characterization of that character as a person, as opposed to that character as a trope, or that character as a type, or that character as a, you know, a familiar stereotype, and more of a fully realized person. I think that's where the differences lie. But yeah. To Shu's point, it's like there's so many cooks in the kitchen, and there are times when things that you put in there, you know, are just authentically things that you, you know, have experienced and will say and all of that kind of stuff. And that tends to come out. But there, you know, I use the example when we were sort of offline. It's like no one knew that, you know, Grey's Anatomy was written by a black woman. Sherman, you're on Shameless, which is a predominantly white show. And so it's just sort of like you've written for Frank, you've written for, you know, and so it's just sort of like, I think anyone behind the pen, as long as you are creating fully realized people, you know, with empathy and with humanity and with scope and with sort of like flaws and all, I think you're just listening to good writing, honestly.
Love that. I agree with everything you guys have just said. I think as a culture, we have maybe gone a tick too far in saying that to create something, you have to have the exact same experiences as the characters you're portraying. And I think we see this happen a lot in acting, but to this article's point, I think it happens a lot in writing too. But people are asking the writers to have the same cultural experience as the characters they're portraying. Now, look, that's helpful, obviously. If you grew up in a black household, you're going to have some insight about how black families deal with each other, for example, how black mothers and black fathers talk to their children, how the children do or do not talk back to their parents. This is going to be very helpful, but I don't think it's the end all be all. I don't think that's the only qualification it takes to write, for example, a black family. And to that point, look, season 4 of The Wire is my favorite season of any television show ever. Mm-hmm. And that is a white showrunner. And I think that he nailed a lot of aspects about black culture, the cadence of black voice, all of that. So, I, you know, this doesn't ring true to me at all. And I would also question, how do these people know, to Shu's original point, how do the people who are surveyed here even know who's writing what?
Right.
I'll give you the example of the recent Emmy-winning episode of television for The Watchmen. Episode 5, I think, won. which was co-written by a black writer.
Actually, episode 7-1. No, actually, episode 6.
Oh, which, I'm sorry, Court Jefferson's episode didn't win?
Episode 6, that was the one that won. The Extraordinary Something of Being.
Okay. Yeah, I think I got the number wrong. But I think if I'm correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kay, that was co-written by Court Jefferson, a black writer,
yes,
and Damon Lindelof, yes, a white writer, right?
He co-wrote all of them. Like, so, that was, but, yeah.
Yeah, but to my point is, that to me, that was a great episode. It focused on black people.
Yep.
What lines of dialogue did Cord write, and what lines of dialogue did Damon write? How would you ever be able to distinguish which, yep, what the white writer brought to the script, and what the black writer brought to the script? You can't separate the two. And if you say you know the difference, I have to sort of be very, I have to call you a liar, basically. But to put it politely, I'll just say I'm dubious.
Here's another point I'd like to make to just jump on to that. Part of the reason that I know the answer is no is not just my experience in rooms and writing, but also because I think there's a flaw embedded in the question. What I mean is that, like, the reason I know it's no that you can't tell is because nobody really considers these questions when it comes to white characters or white people.
Yeah.
Talk about
and
it.
The reason they don't is because, and this is something we have to keep fighting against in our business, but this acceptance of white people, characters, point of view as the default, as ordinary, as the established position. So everything else that's written outside of that point of view, black people, women, people of color, whatever, is gets the lens, gets the sort of the microscope on it and looked at, right? Mm-hmm. And determine and gets questions like, can you tell whether or not this was written by a person of color or not? The reason I know the answer is no is because all those white characters, that's what most writers of color, for example, in television, you're going to write a ton of white people. I have, you have, Kay has, we all have.
Yeah.
Right? And I know for a fact, you can't tell that black people wrote those characters.
Excuse me. When I watch This Is Us, I go, Shakri and Kay really dropped the ball on depicting this white character. That character sounds black as hell. That's supposed to be a white character? Oh, I don't believe it. Turn this off.
Right. Out here speaking completely different. Like,
yeah, why is Kate speaking in Ebonics? I don't know what the hell.
It's crazy. Black vernacular. The white person doesn't say I'm finna go to the store. Who wrote this?
But like to that point, it's just so like I think that's part of what it is. It's like, are you looking to hear Ebonics? Are people looking to like what exactly is it? I think it goes all the way down to sort of like the notion of like, what does it mean to talk black? I think there is a vernacular. I think there's a colloquial nature, but it's just sort of like a lot of times dialogue is dialogue. People talking are people talking.
It's specific. I totally agree with that. It's specific to the character.
Yeah.
You know, when I write black characters, I am considering lot about their life. Mm-hmm. Is this a black person who grew up in an all black working class neighborhood and then went to college? That's somebody who talks differently than somebody who grew up in the suburbs, a black person who grew up in the suburbs. That's somebody who talks differently than a black person who grew up in a West Indian household where their parents were immigrants, and so on and so forth, all through the wide range of experiences of the 40 million black people who live in this country. So even the idea that there is one way that you can tell black people talk is so ridiculous. Like, give me an example and I'll show you a black person who talks completely opposite to that. I do think it's predicated on this. Is predicated a word?
Yeah, I'm going with it. If discombobulated is a word, predicated can be a word.
I don't know. I don't think I use that correctly. But what I'm saying is if it's based on this notion that there's one stereotypical way that black people speak, which I think is what Kay was getting at, I reject that wholly. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
All right, let's introduce formally our guest here, because that's a good place to sort of segue. So our guest today is Kay Oyegun, my former coworker, my friend, writer.
I was going to say former friend. I was going to be like,
no.
Former friend, current guest.
My friend Kay, who is a writer producer on This Is Us, amongst many other things, writes features and television. Really, truly one of the rising stars in Hollywood, in film and television. No question about that. We're so excited to have her on the show. Welcome, Kay.
Thanks, Shin.
I want to say that I'm really excited to have Kay here because Kay represents our first guest that I don't know personally. Which is exciting. I think that is sort of an indication that the podcast is branching out. We're getting out of our comfort zone where only one of the hosts know the guest today. So I'm super excited to
Till you guys start talking to people neither of you know. Just like a straight up stranger.
I don't think that'll ever happen.
That sounds so scary, Kay.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh God. Well, never mind. Isn't that how podcasts go? You're supposed to talk to like different interesting people, not just mildly interesting people that you already know.
Who's mildly interesting?
Child, me. I'm raising my hand on that. But it's like you should talk to. Well, never mind. Sorry, I want to note your podcast. So I
because you know what?
No, please. We need notes. We need heavy. Yeah, we need heavy notes, bro. No.
The thing is, this is supposed to be intimate, familiar. You know, colloquial. It's not 60 minutes. We're not gonna interview somebody we really don't know. Maybe later. Who knows?
Okay.
So, just to give you a sense of sort of the power and the influence of KUA, I almost fucked up your last name, of K O'Yegan, just to give you a sense of it, I worked on This Is Us for two seasons. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite people in the room, if not my favorite person in the room, was Kay.
Oh, and you do, Shu. I tried to convince him not to go. It was such a every day I'd threaten him, be like, "Are you sure about this?" And since then, I've been threatening him to come back.
Whatever I leave, just to give you a sense of her power. Whatever I leave, you know, this is a big show, one of the biggest shows in broadcast history. Whenever I go around and sort of tell people, you know, I used to work on This Is Us or whatever. The first words that come out of their mouth are, "Oh, really? Do you know Kay?"
That's not true.
That is the first thing always. Do you know Kay? Can we get in touch with Kay? Is there a way? Can you give me her email address?
What an unbelievable waste of their time. Shoot, we have to tell them.
So, not to blow you up, but the people are always out here looking for you. So Kay, we like to do. You know, we always like to talk about breaking in stories. People like to hear that and really talk to people about not just where they are, but like where they came from. So could you tell us a little bit about like, how did you make the decision to go into screenwriting to begin with? And how did you get your first break?
Yeah, I did not intentionally go into screenwriting as like a thing. When I got out of college, I went to University of Pittsburgh. And while I was there, I wrote for the school paper. I was a journalism major and I wrote for the school paper and I got a job out of college working at Nightly News in New York. And so I was like 21 working in Nightly News. I was now in the heart of New York City, a complete dum-dum and just sort of like, you know, being required to do things that I love and they were exciting and super, you know, just different every single day and all that stuff. A lot of what I do now is a weird sort of like different version of what I did then. So it's kind of similar industries as far as deadlines, as far as writing, as far as sort of like taking elements of things that you see around you and crafting a narrative. But I did that for a little bit. And then I kind of got burnt out in a weird way. Like I was like 24, 23, just being like, this has been so much. And like eating cake for dinner. I was on call 24/7. I'd be like, you know, this accident just happened. And here I go with $50,000 worth of like camera equipment being like, I need an interview. So I was like, this is dangerous. I'm not doing this no more. And so what ended up happening was Comcast came in and bought out Universal. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, this is a sign. Everything went from like orange and red to like purple in like a day. And I was like, it's time to go. And I remember all of my mentors, everyone that I worked with had just been there for so long. And I just sort of could see myself sitting in some of my boss's chairs after like 25 years or 30 years and being like, I love you guys, but this isn't where I want to be. So I was like low key, like depressed or whatever. And so I like went home from New York to Philadelphia and I was like literally laying on the floor and just having one of those like just great woe is me monologues. And my brother was like, why don't you just go to grad school since like you don't know how to do anything? And I was like, that makes sense. And so he like together or whatever, we like were looking at different schools, and I was like, well, I want to eventually like get into like scripted, because I felt so many times while I was working in the news that I wanted to craft the narrative because so many bad things would be happening. And I was like, man, it'd be great if this happened or that happened. And I was like, girl, don't change the story. That's, you know, what that Mr. Glass did or whatever. And so we ended up finding like USC Peter Stark producing program. But I ended up applying and then I got in, and I asked my bosses if I could still be working for NBC while I was in Los Angeles. And they sort of transferred me to the Today Show out here. So I came out here with a job, thank the Lord, because I'd be too nervous and stuff to be out here being like, hire me. Also, like, you know, I gotta like eat and stuff. And so I came out here with a gig as I started school. And I transitioned once school really sort of hit the ground running. And I just became like an intern while I was going to grad school. All the other people in my program who I like, some of them I still talk to, a lot of them left the business. Really? We were basically, yeah, a good chunk of people just across the board just sort of like went on to do other things.
So I want to back up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. You said you came out here and you went to USC, right?
Yep.
So you were going as a full-time grad student at USC and also holding down a full-time job at the Today Show?
How did that work out? It was because like the thing about it was a transition though, right? Because I ended up leaving the show when things got like, okay, I need to like do this full time. I can't sort of, you know, do my job part time. But it's like the way the Today Show works out, it's like it's broken up into those 4 hours, and then you have segments that you have to produce and stuff. And so it's like if you get your story, like the stuff that I covered while I was out here was like, Nadia Suleiman, the Octo Mom. I covered, Kate and William. They're getting married. They came out here for a little bit. I covered Arnold Schwarzenegger and his, you know, nanny, you know, baby mama scandal. So I covered like random stuff, and I did a bunch of Dr. Drew interviews about like kids and drugs and stuff. 2011 was a weird year. very different. I was like, I miss it. There were such adorable news stories.
All right, let's go back to 2011. If that's a weird year, I will take that any day of the week.
Any day of the week. Like, let's just time machine, yo. So I did that. But then when it became like, okay, I really want to focus on school and stuff, I sort of like had my 2 week notice and like transitioned out. I would like, they would every once in a while bring me on to like AP, like a project, but like it went from every couple of stories to like not anymore. And I was just sort of like officially no longer working for NBC. And then I made that shift. And then I interned at Groundswell while I was still a full-time grad student. The other people that were in my program, they were relatively young. I was young, but they were like just got out of college young. And then some people were much older. So it's like the program sort of has a wide breadth of age ranges and experience levels. But I was very much like, I really want to understand this business and da da da. And so I interned at a bunch of places. Every summer you're supposed to do an internship, and I did one at Fox Searchlight, and I ended up staying there for an additional year. As an assistant. So I started out as an intern, then became a second assistant to Taylor Friedman, who's still there, and Zola Mashariki, who left.
So you go to the Peter Stark program, which for anybody that doesn't know is a fairly prestigious producing program in the graduate school.
I would say it's the producing program.
In graduate film schools in America, at least. Producing is not screenwriting. When does that transition happen and how?
Basically you are 100% right. It doesn't happen until 2015 professionally, but I have been writing for a while. My start out or whatever as in news was writing. And I was now an assistant at a bunch of different places where I was reading scripts and doing coverage on a daily basis. I'm the kind of person who I don't like to talk about stuff out loud very much. So I never told anyone that I wanted to be a writer. I never told any of my bosses, any of my friends. nobody, not even family members knew. Well, I think like my mom knew, but she don't care. That's what I wanted to do. And so it was just sort of like, cause I just wanted to like not suck at it, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I knew that everybody, like I was in a bunch of different like assistant groups and like peer stuff, and everyone wanted to be a writer. And I was just sort of like, yeah, we all like have this aspiration, but it's like, you know, I just didn't want to like play myself basically. So I didn't talk about it, but I was writing constantly. I would write every night. I would write on weekends. So many assistants have the same story, you know, essentially, but we would just, you write a bunch of bad stuff. You write a bunch of, you know, whatever stuff. I think the big problem during that period, because I was so self-conscious, was just the fact that I wasn't like, in order to get better, you have to share your work, right? Exactly. And it's like, people have to read it. They have to give you notes. And I was out here just writing in a vacuum, just weeping every day. Like, this is terrible. So finally I got enough, you know, courage, I guess, to sort of say it to one of my coworkers, and he was a manager at the company that I was working for, BBC Worldwide. And BBC, it was like the version of BBC that's like the American handle of BBC. And I was there for a couple of years, assisting three executives. So I was assisting two VPs and then one SVP. And so so while I was doing that, I was like writing on the weekends, I was writing at night. And I finally told him that I wanted to be a writer. And it was like weirdly nerve-wracking. Like I was telling him I had like an STD or something. I was like, I have to tell you something. He's like,
I have to come out. I'm a writer.
Exactly. I was just like, I have to come out. I want to be a writer. And he was so like kind about it. It was much more dramatic than it needed to be. But he was so sweet. And he was like, I'll read your crap. And like, he was just very like, and so he became kind of like my person, and he was just a very smart reader, and he was a very thoughtful note giver. And I think I trusted him, and I really liked him. And I think that was why I felt like I could show him, because there are a lot of times we had been reading stuff and he had just these like brilliant thoughts on it. And I was like, dang, it would be great if I got his point of view on stuff I was working on. And so at that point I had like a writing partner, this woman, Paul, I called you a woman. in my mind, I'm like, we're women. She's a woman. She's 30-something, named Paula. And she was sort of one of my favorite people on the planet. And we were writing together, and we had written like a New Girl spec. I went off and wrote an Orange is New Black spec. Then, you know, we did like a Shameless spec. Haha, Sherman.
I'll read it. I'll take it.
And we did like, we were just like specking everything. We were just so in love with shows and content and stuff. But anyway, I had written this like Friday Night Lights-esque parenthood type thing. And by then I had left that show and I was off to ABC. I had left that job and I was at ABC Studios working in the comedy division. And I was an assistant in comedy. There were a bunch of us around. And I still wasn't telling any other human being that I was a writer.
Okay. I want to jump in.
Yeah.
Because Shu and I had a long talk about spec scripts and how we do not find them useful as a tool to break in. So can you correct us? Tell us where we're wrong about that. You just listed about three or four different specs that you wrote. And, you know, about specking stuff for existing shows, writing an episode of existing shows that you're not getting paid or hired to write just for practice and for an example of your work. Tell us why you thought that was useful at the time.
I thought it was useful because honestly, I didn't know what the rules were or not or whatever. I just knew that spec scripts were things that existed. And those shows I loved, those shows I had watched so many episodes of and like absolutely adored. And I knew that like my original stuff were like, I guess, fine or whatever. I don't know. I never really knew how to qualify my original work. I just sort of like was just like, oh, I wrote a pilot. What's a pilot? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know how to like really, does that make sense? Like, I didn't know how to, it was just like a thing I had written. Cool. But then I was like, when I wrote other shows, I could see it. Like, I could understand and I could see it because I was like, I've seen the show. So it made more sense to me, weirdly enough, at that time. And so that's part of why I did it. I love New Girl so much. I could, like, I watched so many episodes, I could write it. I loved Shameless. I could write that. Like, so it's like, and then Orange is the New Black, literally, after I binged the first season in about, like, you know, a day, I had everything about the second season first episode I could see so clearly. And so I wrote that in like this fever dream, and it's still one of my favorite things I ever wrote. And the funniest thing, I sent it to a friend of mine who didn't know I was a writer, but who was in the it was in Stark with me, and she actually was friends with this guy who was an assistant at CAA, and she sent it to him, and then he sent it he sent it to Olivia Blaustein. And at that time, Olivia Blaustein, who's an agent now, a really like sort of big fancy agent now with CAA, who knows what agencies are anymore, but Olivia, you the best. He sent it to Olivia Blaustein, who was the assistant to, I can't remember his name, but the agent who oversaw Genji's, who was Genji's agent. And uh-huh. So she read it.
Genji being the creator of Orange is the New Black.
K's on a first name basis, dude. Come on.
I really
Listen. Hey, she's said some names. She's very familiar with some power players. I don't know all these names, but I'm just trying to break it down.
You are watching. You are witnessing why she has wide power and wide influence. Do you hear what's happening? These are all these names. Like
I always like to attribute people's experiences, and people gonna be listening to it like, who's Paula? Who's Joey? Who's Olivia? So please say who are they? But Olivia at that point was an agency trainee, and she read the Orange is New Black script and she loved it, and she hit me up and to sort of like sit, and this was like 2014 or 13, one of them years, I don't even remember no more. And she was just sort of like, girl, like this is so, you know, this is great. This is in the voice of it. I was like, I thought it was like, you know, she was very complimentary and was just sort of like, we're going to keep you on our radar. And I didn't know what she was talking about. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what was going on, but I was like, okay, like this is about to be whatever. And they were like, if there's anything else you're writing, like, you know, just like let us know. So it was one of those things where like a lot of people get like on people's radars, whatever that is. And so that's what happened. Nothing went from it, but Olivia and I became cool. I knew that I was like in a space where I really, really loved, but that ended up leading to this original spec that I'd written that at first was this like parenthood Friday Night Lights thing that I gave to Joey to read. And he really responded to it. He gave me some notes and some thoughts. I wasn't quite sure. And then this is what happened. Michael Brown happened. And when Michael Brown was killed, it was sort of like, I remember like wanting to go to Ferguson, and I remember like, and I talked to friends of mine about wanting to go to Ferguson and just being like, I was so angry and so sad. And he looks like Michael Brown looks like my brother. Like he's like a big, like sort of like, you know, heavy Black dude. And I just remember just like weeping. I just remember just like crying for days and days. And subsequently I feel like we've all just cried and cried and cried. And so I was just so furious and so in a real need to kind of like understand what was going on. And so I took that script that was like Friday Night Lights meets Parenthood, and I just like rewrote it from like start to finish. I just rewrote it with all of my thoughts and all of my feelings about what was going on.
Did this ultimately lead to your breaking in your first?
Yeah, that was the script that got me Queen Sugar.
Got it. Two things, Sherman, I think that are important here. One, we break talk a lot.
Break it down, Brother Shu. Break it down, Brother Shu.
We talk a lot on this. We talk a lot on this podcast about, you know, what it takes to sort of be a writer. Mm-hmm. And I think Kay articulated that quite a bit. Like whatever she was doing, she was writing. When she was an assistant working all day, she was writing at night. And anything, whether it was specs, whether it was something that was original. And she also said they were bad oftentimes. And she just kept writing through them, right?
Yep.
And continuing to produce material, right? And dude, then eventually...
Hold up. Let me say it for the people in the back. Let me break it down to its base element. Writers write.
Writers write, man.
Writers finish write. Scripts. Yeah. Writers have work to share with people. That's all you right. guys talking, all you now and later writers, talk about it now, hope to write it later, get out of my face. If you can't send me the PDF as soon as I ask for it, you're not a writer, bro. Listen to Kay, listen to Shu, listen to the diversity hires. We're giving you the blueprint.
It's really great. And I think the second part of it is that even when you write so much stuff, and so much stuff that was in your voice, but it was ultimately somebody else's show. It was... You know, Orange is the New Black. It was whatever the other ones you said were.
Yeah.
The new girl, etc. Right, and then even something that you had written that was sort of seemed to be good. It was original, but it seemed like, and you correct me where I'm wrong, it wasn't until there was something really personal, mm-hmm. yes, that you could infuse into that script.
Yep.
That made it go to the next level and also took your career to the next level.
Yeah.
And that script has been a workhorse for you, or was a workhorse for you.
Yeah, it would for like for the first like my it was so funny because it's like I sent that after I wrote it and like in like a like not even like because everyone's always like you write in a fever. No, it took me about 9 months to write. Like it took me a little bit of time to write, and I always feel like that's something that like people really should like embrace. Right, it takes time, and so it took me a while to write. I wrote it and then I rewrote 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 it, and finally when I got to a place where I was like, okay, I'm comfortable sharing this. Like I got to a place where I was comfortable sharing. And at that point, I had like a couple of pockets of people who I was sharing material with, but this one I kept relatively close to the chest because it was so personal. And so I like, you know, there were like two people I shared and they gave me thoughts and gave me notes. I sent that to Joey again. And at this point, Joey had like peaced out from the industry. He moved to, you know, Kansas City, and he was like living with his wife and his kids. And, you know, she's like works at a brewery. I at that point I had gotten a job. I left ABC Studios when my boss had put together the show The Muppets, and I got hired by Bob Cushell and Bill Prady to come on board as like their showrunner's assistant for The Muppets. So I transitioned into like a scripted show, and that was like 2015 when The Muppets was gonna like change the world or whatever, and like that didn't happen. And so I moved on to that show. And so I sent it to him in like January, right? So it's like everything that happened with Michael Brown the year before. And I'd written that script for like several months or whatever. Finally, I sent it to Joey in January of 2015. My job on that, on The Muppets sort of like was great, but then like Bill and Bob weren't really seeing eye to eye. And so Bob ended up leaving. And so when a showrunner leaves, his assistant kind of goes too. And so I became unemployed. I was unemployed. Like he left the show in October, and I left the show in October also. And at that point I was like, all right, Jesus. Cause you know, I love me some Jesus. And so like this, my whole life and career, everything is sort of like shaped by my relationship with God. And I was like, well, God, now I'm unemployed. I'm a writer person, but I know you got me. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what it was. So I was in my, like, you know, my apartment that was over on Cherokee Boulevard, that was over a police station, just sort of like writing. I had no curtains on my window. So every time it was nighttime, I would like turn my lights off because I was scared, because across the street was like this parking lot and they could all see just like into my
Kay, you could have found some curtains, Kay.
I know. Come
you
on.
You could have got some bed sheets, something. You could have done.
Here's what happened. So I use a bed sheet to like hang at the top of my thing, because it was like one of those like studio apartments in Hollywood that are like all brick. So you can't really like shove things into it, because I tried to put curtain rods in there. I tried, but they fell, shoe. They fell so many times. So what I had to do was I had to string from the wall, from like the ceiling, like from one side to another, just like a sheet, because it was just sort of like nothing else could stick in. Don't get that apartment, y'all.
That's all right. You are rich. You are fabulously wealthy now. So you have come a long way.
Many years of that not being the case. I grew up in the village of Nigeria. So this is all good.
So, Kay, I want to ask you a little bit about your experience as a writer working on television staffs, but I'm really curious, how do you make the transition from a worker bee on television staff to somebody with an overall deal at one of the biggest television companies? You have an overall at Fox, right?
Yeah, it's a 20th, yeah.
And so that's huge for people listening. That's like a dream of some writer. So I would love to know, how do you make that transition?
I have no idea. Ask the Holy Spirit. Genuinely, I honestly, it's one of those things where I don't know how it happened in totality. I've been so unbelievably blessed in my experience on This Is Us. My first job was on Queen Sugar, and I was there for the first season, and it was unbelievable the way in which, you know, Melissa Carter sort of like ran the room, the way in which Anthony Sparks, who runs the show now, kind of shepherded, you know, the space for us to be able to create. I learned a lot. I consider that like my grad school of you know, writing, basically. And then going into This Is Us, I was a staff writer when I started. And I think the way in which the show works, and the way Dan, Isaac, and Elizabeth with, who are the showrunners of the show, the way they allow for autonomy in an odd way to kind of come in and make the thing what you want it to be was something that I was able to thrive in as a person who had a point of view and who is collaborative, has a point of view and all of those things. So I was sort of between writing and then being very active. I care. I love being on set. I love every person that works on our production. I love our crew. You know, I spend a lot of time in those spaces. And I was able to gain their trust, I guess, you know, I am involved in a bunch of different spaces on the show. And so I think because of that and point of views on the show, there were a lot of things that I ended up both volunteering for and sort of stepping up to do on a relatively consistent basis. And I'd written this thing that, you know, had gotten to 20th and all that stuff. And I honestly don't know the machinations of it, but it ended up being a situation where it was like, you know, the show kind of said, we don't want Kay to leave until it's done, essentially. Like, we want her to stay until the end of it. And I was just sort of like, sure, me being myself, I was just sort of like, sure, I'll do that. But it's like, no, you know, there's like a legal way to do that. And so that's when the overall conversation started, essentially. And so it was really just to sort of, honestly, I think that's kind of how, I don't know how it happens for other people, but that's kind of how it worked out here.
So you made yourself indispensable. I mean, it sounds like you did the extra stuff. Yeah. You worked really hard at your, you know, what was on your job description, but you also stepped up to do a lot of other stuff, and they decided that this show would not work without you.
Yes.
And thus the production company brought that bag to keep you around.
But that bag.
I mean, I don't even want to. Like, I don't want to pocket check K. But I'm sure it's looking real.
Shut up.
I mean, you're not just gonna stay around for free. You don't stay around on a hit show for free. Agents would have been derelict in their duty to not have them bring that bag. That's all I'm saying.
I will say this, it is a first overall, so it's reflective of that, and I'm happy and grateful, and you know, it is I never have a reason to complain, and I really don't have a reason to complain, so I'm grateful.
Wait, Kay, real quick for everybody who's listening, what exactly is an overall deal?
An overall deal is when you are sort of contracted to whichever studio you're contracted with to create content for them and to potentially oversee content that's created by other people.
That's dope. And you write movies as well. Does your overall deal include movies, or are you a free agent?
It doesn't. Like, I had to, my last thing that I set up, I had to like make sure that 20th knew, and like, they were like, okay, cool. And just sort of like let them know I can't write TV movies to competitors. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'd have to, again, they have to be with quotes on it, theatrical, which who knows what that looks like anymore, but they have to be theatrical. And if they end up moving to streaming, that wasn't an intention, but I can't intentionally write TV movies.
Word.
Whatever that means.
Can you tell me and Shakri how to get an overall deal? Should we seek out an overall deal? Like, what? You know, I wonder
what? She was like, speak for yourself, Sherman.
No, because, you know, listen, I mean, we should break down the different types of overall deals, because I think the overall deals that often make it to the headlines are these huge overall deals that somebody like Shonda would get at Netflix, or, you know, you hear about Greg Berlanti. Those are nine-figure deals, right? Those are hundreds of millions of dollars. But for a working writer, an overall deal looks very different. They're not going to buy you an office or an assistant.
They gave me both of those.
They did? They gave you an office and an assistant? Come on.
Yeah.
So you have a... Bro. What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. This is Kale Yeager we're talking to.
You have to stop that.
I'm trying to figure out the different levels of overall deals. I think that's important for people to know. A lot of writers I know who have overall deals, it's literally just it's very lucrative, and it's pretty much a hold on their services, right? It's that they want them to write for whatever show they're on, they want them to bring them new material, and they want to keep them as an upper level possible showrunner for new productions.
That's
I'm trying to figure out at what level K is, and is it something that everybody should seek out? I don't know. I'm trying to learn here, Shu.
I'm just fucking with you. I think that's a great question. And I also just real quick, like, I'm curious just to piggyback on that, like, from a craft perspective, like a creative perspective, what is it like working under a deal like that? And I guess that may fit with Sherman's question is like, should people seek it? What are the positives and negatives? Like, you have to create ideas and pitches, I would imagine, for this company, as opposed to sort of coming up with stuff on your own that you might want to take around. How does that all work?
It works exactly like that. And I think, Sherman, you hit it sort of like you are, you know, you're contracted to sort of go supervise other shows and bring shows. But yeah, but the bringing of shows, you have to do that. Like, I can't not bring a show. Like, I have to sort of, like, every year of my deal, you have to bring something in, or they have to set something up with you, whether they bring you a book, whether they bring you, you know, a new writer, or whether another overall wants to work with you on a project that you sort of set up at one of the studios. And so one of the networks, which are FX, Hulu, Disney Plus, ABC, you know, those are the family studios based networks. And so, yeah, it's creatively, it's great as far as like, you're constantly challenged to create. I used to have I write a new pilot every year and most of the time they're just like for me, sort of like keep flexible and keep nimble. But you're required to bring them. Do I think people should chase them? Why not? I think people should chase everything they want to chase. I definitely know I didn't have an imagination for it, so I didn't chase it. Because at the time when this conversation started, I was a mid-level, you know what I mean, writer. And so it's like, I didn't even, you know, this is, the Holy Spirit. Look, Jesus.
Won't he do it? Won't
exactly. He do it? It was definitely not, it wasn't anything I was asking. Cause I didn't, you know, like a lot of times we don't even know what to ask for. And so it's like, I'm not going to be a story editor being like, you know what I need, you know what I mean? Like,
is that the level you were when you got offered your overall deal, a story editor?
I was a co-producer when the conversation began in earnest. And then I was a producer when I got offered the overall deal. So it was just sort of like the rumblings or whatever had like started when I was around the third season. So yeah.
Dope.
Can we talk real quick, Sherman? Am I jumping on you?
Well, I was going to ask you, Shu. I was going to throw it back to you.
Yeah.
You know, you listen. You're a guy who is extremely sought after. I know that. I know that companies are essentially banging down your door all the time. You tell me off, you know, you don't brag on mic, but off mic, you basically tell me every single company in Hollywood is trying to get in business with you.
I'm not too creepy, man.
What did you say?
I never say that. That's not true.
Okay. Whatever. Be humble now. He just brags nonstop off mic. So I'm wondering. I'm just curious, like, have these conversations started for you? Have you ever felt like an overall deal was a possibility for you? Is it something that you wanted your reps to really chase? Where are you in terms of your career and a potential overall? And how attractive does it sound to you?
Well, that's why I was curious to hear from Kay also, because I think it's one of those things like you said, it probably has positives and negatives, it's not something.
I don't know. It sounds pretty positive. It sounds like they backed the Brinks truck up to Kay's house and just unloaded.
They sure didn't. We backed the baskets over to their house. Like, it was just like, it was like, you're not going, come on with it. So that's more what it was. Don't worry. The way is like, God is good. They're going to back it up one day. So
I'll tell you what, just for the theme of the podcast, like, I'll tell you what I think is really good about overall deals in this context. I think in 2020 and going forward, 2021, in this era, I think it's really important for writer, producer, creators, especially in television, to be connected to studios and have those studios put their money where their mouth is for those creators. I think it's probably a more important time than ever for those big multinational studios who say their mission is to you know, increase diversity, equity, and inclusion, to bring those deals to the talent and allow those people to create shows that, you know, tell our stories. I think that's important, even if they're not necessarily shows about Black people, but that you have Black creators sitting in those seats, I think is huge. So on that end, yeah, it's positive.
What I'll say truthfully is very simply this, because what I get hit up about, like, do you know this person who's available for this thing? Do you know this person? And it's just sort of like everybody, most people that I know, I don't want to say everybody because I might, you know, be, people might be going through situations that they're not vocal about, but most people I know are working and are really busy and have multiple things on their plate. And so it's like the pipeline has to open up, right? And so it's like what I'm grateful for is the opportunity to set up shows and then hire people.
Yes.
Put them on, yes. Help them yes. grow and move up the ranks. And then now the sort of like the pool of folks to sort of like hire is just that much wider. So I think us getting overalls, because it's like not for nothing, and this just is what it is. When you're a person of color and you run a room, you likely gonna look like hire other people who yes. look, you know what I mean? It just is what it is. Yes. And so just sort of like now you get people who are moving up in the ranks. You're getting people who are have onset, you know, production skills. You have people who understand the, you know, the machinations of creating a show, whether it's streaming or network or whatever the case is. And now they're equipped to sort of like, you know, step into that role. And that's my goal. That's honestly my mission. That's my goal. That's what's on my heart. That's what I want to do. So all of my shows, making sure that from post-production, production to cast, to crew, to writers, everybody are people who are now in the funnel and in the system to sort of make things happen for themselves.
Yo, I have to that is so huge. I have to co-sign that big time. I think bigger than, I mean, Sherman and I were fucking around with the Brinks truck of money and all that. That is important to one individual.
Yeah, it's like,
speak for yourself. The bag is very important.
It's important to one individual, but the biggest importance, Kay hit it right on the head, is that that's why these things. So to answer your question, yeah, I guess I am in favor of it big time. I'm seeking my overall deal right now. Whoever wants to give me a call, my phone lines are open, because Kay is right. That the real advantage is about becoming a curator for other talent. And so when the industry says, we can't find the Black people, we can't find the writers of color, we can't find the whatever. Well, you know, you set up these deals so that these folks can go out and create the space for those people to come up. I think that's well said, Kay. I love that.
That's you're going to be amazing. Very well. Yes, and please, you know, I'll email you my resume after this.
Yes.
And please keep me in mind for future projects.
So silly. Sherman, y'all don't, the Sherman, Shukri, y'all don't need me. Go ahead, carry on. We all know we have your work.
You know, I have maybe the last question. I don't know. Shu, you might have more questions, but I wanted to ask you about, in the context of your overall deal, you talk about setting up your own projects, bringing your studio new ideas, them possibly partnering you with other people, putting you on shows, getting you sort of to be the boss that you already are. How do you imagine that working while you're still on a hit network television show? How do you imagine, you know, I look at these people who are showrunners of multiple shows, and I can't even fathom it. Because when I'm on one show, it seems like it takes all of my time and effort. So can you speak a little bit about how you might organize that both professionally, managerially, and also creatively?
I mean, by the grace of God, honestly, I don't know how any of it is going to happen. I'm in the middle of it right now. Mm-hmm. And it's one that I'm sort of like seeking guidance from my bosses, because Isaac and Elizabeth, who run This Is Us, also have Love, Simon. And they have a showrunner there also on Love, Simon, who's sort of day to day, but they're also very involved. And so it's just sort of like, it is possible, but it's something that I really wanted to like understand. And so there are a couple of things right now that have been, you know, bought and sort of like are in the works. And so it's just sort of like, I'm trying to figure out how, like, I'm fine and comfortable writing, you know, myself, but it's like, as far as like, I can't be in two places at once, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I'm very much committed to the show until the very end. Like, I want to, like, you know, kiss, you know, stage 31 and 32, you know, with my mask on when it's all over. It's just sort of just been such a blessing. And the idea of being able to be there from the beginning to end, Shukri, is something.
Dan is gonna holler at me at season 6 or whatever the last season is. And
tell him, you keep playing around, you finna get a call, and you're gonna be like,
I'll come in for a special, you know, reunion.
A special reunion? How about you know what? We gonna talk about that offline. But anyway, it's just I am still waiting to see how that goes. But the truth is, they buy something, right? You write the pilot, and then they may not pick it up, and then you're like, that was fun, and then you just sort of keep going. You don't want to bank on that because that's not like the goal. But, you know, that's also something that happens quite a lot.
Yeah, the numbers are against you, right? Like
the numbers are never against me, Sherman. I'm a child of God.
No. Yeah, of course. I'm not trying to undercut that. What I'm saying is, all it takes is one project to go and then another project to go. It doesn't, the four or five projects that might not have worked out beforehand, they sort of fade and recede into the background as the next opportunity comes up. So I'm not, definitely don't want to go against God. God's got the numbers in his favors. I'm just saying that in this industry, a project that fizzles out isn't always the worst thing in the world, because for talented writers like yourself, there will always be another opportunity, and the next thing might be even bigger and better.
Yeah. I mean, and the truth of the matter is, I think you just sort of have to, I'm of the mindset that, like, I only work on things that I'm very passionate about, just because there are a lot of balls, you know, very sort of transparently and honestly in the air at every given time. And so there are deadlines, and what it's helped me, there are deadlines on the feature side with multiple things going, and then there are deadlines on the show side. And like this year I'm directing. And so it's just sort of like, there's just a bunch of stuff that's like moving all at once. And so everything that I work on, you have to be very passionate about it, because in order for me to like go to the computer and give someone something that's worth their time and worth reading, you want to sort of put your all, you know, into it. So that's my only mandate. So I'm not the kind of person who necessarily like jumps at everything. But what I do is, like, if this is not for me, I try to let that executive know these are four other people who this would be great for. And so, just because it's like this project shouldn't just languish or whatever, or should go to somebody else who may be, you know, in a different space to do it.
Kay, this has been great. There's so much more we could absolutely talk about, but I think we should cut it off there. And you know,
with the promise that, Kay, you got to come back.
Yeah. Have to. Oh my goodness, I'm doing this like in my like kitchen. This is great.
Got to come back.
Thanks,
great to have you.
Kay, is there a place where people can follow you on social media? Do you want to talk about any upcoming projects people should check out? Feel free to use this point to plug whatever you got going on.
Oh man, guys, get out and vote.
Yes. Word.
The end.
That's the best plug. We should leave it there, Shu.
All right, folks. We like to end every episode with our favorite segment, which is called Don't Do That Shit. And would you explain, Sherman, what is Don't Do That Shit?
It's a pretty simple, Shu. We just tell you what not to do in your screenplays, what not to do as you move through this industry. It's just a little piece of advice that we like to give to you in the form of telling you what not to do. Straightforward.
Now, would you like to start with the first don't do that shit?
Absolutely. It's a small one today. It's not like a big overarching career advice or how to get your scripts right or anything like that. It's just a very small one.
This is no big bombs. This is just
no big bombs. I have some big bombs coming in further weeks, but this one is one that's been nagging at me. Stop saying "we see" so much in your script. That's the conceit. That's the conceit of the script, bro. Everything you're writing, we see. We get it. That's the way a screenplay works. What you write is what we see. And the dialogue you write is what we hear. You don't need to say, we see the character walk down the street. Just say, the character walks down the street. I guarantee you this. If you send me your script and the first words of your first action block are "we see," I'm deleting your script. It's going in the trash, man. I will never get further than that. Chill with "we see." Now, here's the exception.
Yeah, I think I'm "we see" because I don't know if I agree. I'm waiting.
Surely this is even not even up for debate, bro. Here's the exception. If you think you need to call out something that the audience needs to notice, especially if other characters who are in the scene are not supposed to notice, then "we see" is a really, really useful tool. For example, you want to show that a character is shoplifting something and other characters don't see it. Say we see the character slip the bracelet into their pocket. We see it's good. It allows you to know that the audience is seeing something that the rest of the characters aren't. Otherwise, just do it once or twice a script. Pick your points, but don't tell me we see over and over again. Do not do that shit. Why do you how could you possibly disagree with that?
Hold on. I'm glad you qualified it because I agree with all of the qualifications.
Okay.
I was just waiting to see because I do think it's useful, but I do not think – I think it's useful in very specific and very sparse.
Yes, small doses.
Yeah.
You should just do a pass of your script, find we see, and if you've done it more than 3 or 4 times over a feature script, really question whether you need to say we see.
I literally just went through like 2 things just did a viewfinder for we see, and I was like, "Ooh, I didn't have none. Sherman not gonna like this."
Okay, you can send me your script now. Kay really needs me to read her script, obviously.
That's a good one. It's sort of like cut to. It's evident. Self evident. We know you're gonna cut to the next scene.
Exactly.
Maybe there's a reason to say that.
The only time I ever use cut to is when it is a jarring move. Exactly. Like there's a comedy punch that I want. Like she's like, you know, I love him. Cut to she hates him. Like it's just sort of like, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes. For emphasis and like really calling out the moments where the cut is telling the story, where the actual editing is going to tell the story, that's a beautiful tool to have. People who use it after every scene, it's you're using it too much. You have rendered it meaningless if you use it so much.
It messes with your page count. Like anything that messes with the page count is so stressful because these scripts got to come at a certain page.
That's right. My don't do that shit is I hope it slots right in here in this episode because Kay actually mentioned part of it in telling her story of breaking in. My don't do that shit this week is don't wait for the perfect draft. Mm-mm. Don't wait for the perfect draft. That means part of writing, a big part of writing, is writing to a place where you know it's imperfect. You know things need to change. You know it's going to need to be rewritten, but you got to share it and you got to get feedback and you got to put it out there anyway. You got to accept that vulnerability. So do not wait for the perfect draft in order to share it or to get that feedback because there is no such thing.
And you can tweak it forever. I mean, you could really, a script is not done until it's like in the movie theaters or on the TV, right? You can tweak a script forever. And the idea here, I think, Shu, if I could jump in, is
please.
It's not you don't purposely send out a bad script, obviously. You get it to a point that you really love it and you really think it's working, but you cannot be crippled by going line for line every single day until you get the exact punctuation, the exact word. You know, at some point you have to let the thing go and let it live on its own merits, knowing that there's always more work to do.
That's right. The only way you get better is putting work out there, getting feedback, revising and doing it again, rinse, repeat. That's the only way to perfect the craft, which is to say there is no perfecting the craft, but that's the only way to sort of get closer to the perfection of the craft. All right. Kay, I'm throwing it to you just to see if there's any way that you have thought of or have a don't do that shit.
I do. It's kind of a don't and then a do that sort of go hand in hand. I would say don't be so hard on yourself, but do hold yourself accountable. I think it's something that, you know, there's such a hunger to break in. And I always say to people, like, breaking in isn't really like the other side of breaking in is just more work. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like I had much more of a social life before I broke in. it's just like you're breaking into a job. You're breaking in to professionally sit at a computer. And so it's just sort of like, that's really what it is. So it's like, if that's not what you're doing before you break in, or at least that's not what you enjoy before you break in, you're frankly going to hate breaking in. And so being clear about that, but it's like, don't be, I think a lot of people are so hard on themselves because they have these expectations of what they think the business is supposed to be like, what their scripts are supposed to be like, that the first person who reads it is supposed to love it, that those scripts mm-hmm. are never going to get better. And like, they have all of these things. And I think the words that the voices and the words that they say to themselves kind of end up being the things that cripple them from moving forward. You know, I remember that period. I remember those voices and it is crippling, but I think hold yourself accountable to finish the content, to finish the work, to finish the script, to get the notes, to do those things. Hold yourself accountable, but don't, you know, whip yourself if something is imperfect. So I think it's sort of making sure you find the balance between those two very real things.
Well said. This has been a great episode.
One of the best.
So let's wrap it up, Sherm. Shall we do?
Shall we do it?
What did I say? Shall we do? Shall we do it?
That does it for today's episode of The Diversity Hires. I'm your host, Sherman Payne.
And I'm Shukri Hassan Tillman, a.k.a. Shu. Please follow and subscribe to this podcast anywhere that you find podcasts. And listen, you can find us at thediversityhires.com. You can write us a message on Facebook, on Instagram, at DivHiresPod. And if you want to hear something on the show that we haven't covered, feel free. We always take suggestions. This show is produced by the wonderful August K. Burton, AKB. Shout out.
That's it. We'll see you in the episode. Peace.